Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we have an exciting guest, a modern-day Horatio Alger, who brought himself from rags to riches with a deep commitment to social justice, rooted in a profound spiritual awareness of the connection and wonder of life. We begin first with a brief comment on recent events in Charlottesville, Virginia. This week, Nazis and white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, where they attacked counter-demonstrators, killing one woman and injuring dozens more. Appallingly, the president claimed there was equal blame on both sides, despite all evidence that it was the white supremacists who were the aggressors, showing up ready for battle with helmets, shields, and weapons. It was a self-described Nazi who drove his car into peaceful protesters, killing a young woman and seriously injuring 19 others. The white supremacists were in Charlottesville to protest the removal of a statue to Robert E. Lee, the leader of the Confederate. The Confederates were traitors to our country, organizing an armed rebellion against the United States to defend slavery. All monuments to Confederate traitors should be removed. Waving the Confederate flag is not a tribute to Southern honor. It is a reminder of the scourge of slavery and treason and should be vigorously denounced. In the absence of moral leadership by our president, it is up to we the people to speak out against the white supremacists and Nazis. If we are complacent, we are complicit. My father and other Americans did not risk their lives fighting the Nazis in World War II so they could rise in America. While taking a strong stand against the evils of racism and anti-Semitism, it's important to keep a space open for the perpetrators of evil to change. As Gandhi advised, hate the sin, not the sinner. We can be guided by the wisdom of Nelson Mandela, who said, "No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love." Our country needs leaders with strong values who can take a stand against the evils of racism and anti-Semitism while keeping a space open for the perpetrators to change. Some of our best leaders are guided by moral values based on an understanding that we are all members of the human family. How do people develop a sense of moral values? How do we get the courage to act publicly on those moral values? How do we develop a sense of connection with our fellow Americans? Our guest today can help us address these and many other issues. Reverend Dr. Jim Sherblum is the author of a new book, Spiritual Audacity, a memoir of lessons learned from his amazing life, rising from a poor small-town boy to the heights of being a successful businessman, then becoming a Unitarian minister. Jim holds a BA from Yale, an MBA from Harvard, and both a Master's in Divinity and Doctor of Ministry degrees from Andover Newton Theological School. Jim began his career as a strategy consultant with Bain & Company, working in Boston, London, and Munich. He went on to become a leader in the biotech industry. He was founder and president of the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council. As an entrepreneur, he served as senior vice president and CFO of Genzyme Corporation and as chair and CEO of TSI Corporation. He then became a venture catalyst, a major investor and guide to new companies. He was involved in the creation of 6 biotechnology and healthcare companies and an early investor in at least 12 more. At midlife, Jim had a spiritual awakening and emerged as a spiritual teacher and preacher. He served in parish ministry at First Parish Church in Brookline, Massachusetts. He is also a classmate of mine from Yale. He has written a fascinating memoir titled Spiritual Audacity, 6 Disciplines of Human Flourishing, which is about to be released. Jim is here with us today to talk about what he has learned on his remarkable journey. Jim Sherblum, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I'm delighted to be with you.
Yes, I love your memoir. I love reading it, and I hope all our listeners will get it and read it. Before we talk about that, I just wanted to create a space and invite you to comment if you had anything to say about the march in Charlottesville, Virginia this week.
Yeah, a lot of what's going on seems to be people are caught trying to project onto each other or trying to act out of a place of fear and anxiety. And I think it's important to remember that America is now in the midst of a historic transition from a country that has always been governed and ruled by a white majority to one that will be governed and ruled by a non-white majority. And that's a scary transition for all concerned. Unfortunately, physical violence to try to protect and maintain white supremacy is likely to be a factor in our lives for the foreseeable future. This transition is not going to happen without a lot of pain and suffering. But the transition costs are tragic, yet the ultimate outcome looks clear, that we are going to end up with a country that is ruled by a non-white majority. So the question for me is, how do we help minimize the violence and pain during this time of transition while helping to bring about a more diverse and fair American culture? And for me, that a lot of it comes down to, as my spiritual teachers would say, looking to the fundamental sense of self that people bring to the party. Now, my Islamic Sufi teachers have always said that we each have seven potential selves: the tyrannical self, the moral self, the inspired self, the serene self, the pleasing self, and then the pure self. And it feels to me like much of the violence we're currently seeing is people operating only out of their tyrannical or regretful self or moral self. The tyrannical or selfish self wants whatever it wants. It doesn't really care what impact it has on other people. It can ultimately do us great harm, and it's the self we must learn to surrender to the greater good. The moral self, also called the regretful self, is a natural state of childhood. It's the stage of human development when we are habitually self-centered. When childhood ends, we're told by the spiritual teachers we should put away childish things, including these violent actions to assert our ego self. So I'm thinking what we need now is more spiritual disciplines to cultivate our higher selves, what Abraham Lincoln called the angels of our better nature.
That's well said, and that's exactly what your book is all about, is those spiritual disciplines that can help us develop the better angels of our nature.
Right.
So
we all have the capability to be these better people that we were born capable of being, and now the question is, can we provide disciplines and practices that will help people to discover who they were born to be?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's talk about your journey in life, and then I do want to come back to these spiritual disciplines you're talking about to develop the better angels of our nature. I think part of the power of your message is your power as a messenger, because you were someone who grew up in a poor family, went on to Yale College, Harvard Business School, and a highly successful career in business. And a lot of people look at that, and that's kind of where they're at, is looking, how do I get out of poverty? How do I bring financial resources to myself and my family and get some financial freedom as a goal? So you walked that path, you ran that path, you flew that path in your career. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that's a great foundation for you, for people to know, you're not floating in on a cloud as some guru. You walk the walk, you talk the talk, you lived that incredible journey. And so tell us, how did you get from being from a poor big family, 10 kids, son of a minister in Rhode Island, how did you get from there to break out and achieve financial freedom?
Well, it's a long process, but for me the most fundamental was having a great resilience. That I've been fascinated by human flourishing, where some people have resilience and come bounce back, and others get crushed by these bad events that happen to me or to them. But I, as you say, I was one, the fifth of 10 kids for a poor Baptist minister down in Tiverton, Rhode Island. We were living on about $3,000 a year, which would be equivalent today to about $20,000 a year for a family of 12. They didn't give me much, but what they did give me were two things. One, a deep desire to find a way out of poverty, to have a different options and a different way of living in life, and a deep sense of self and resilience that let me overcome each of the obstacles that stood in my way. And it's that combination of having a clear intent about what it is you are willing to do anything for, and having a way of embracing the world, engaging with the world, that allows you to overcome tribulations.
Yes, those are critical, a desire to get out of poverty and the deep resilience to deal with what comes your way, the clear intention. I would add to that your mother's gift to you on your love of reading, which
yes.
I can totally relate to. I mean, I was from a similar kind of situation. I grew up in a poor family in the greater Boston area, and we were crammed into a small apartment. But my mother taught us to love reading and love books. In fact, we had a china cabinet. We didn't have much china, but we had lots of books stuffed into the china cabinet and into the clothes closets. Anywhere, any available space was full of books. So, I think that was an incredible gift that our mothers gave to us.
Yes, and I think that may well be why you and I both ended up at Yale. Is that you needed something that let you, or for me, that drew me beyond the education that I could get at Tiverton High School, that would allow me to be prepared to enter into an elite university, which no one from that school had ever done before.
Right, exactly. That love of reading, and also the discipline to do the homework, do the work, be engaged in all the extracurricular activity, but... Yes, I was the first girl from my town to go to Yale. It was highly unusual to have anybody go to Yale from my public high school, Winthrop, Massachusetts. So there we are. I had an amazing experience at Yale because it was the first time I met rich people. And it was quite a bit to navigate socially and culturally coming from a poor family and being surrounded by a lot of really wealthy students. And you talk with great insight and honesty about the challenges you faced socially and culturally at Yale. But what was it like for you to come out of your small town and then kind of be at Yale with these mostly very wealthy elite students?
Well, frankly, it was humiliating that it was only recently that the Ivy Leagues had started opening the doors to promising students who were coming from public high schools that were not preparing them for that. In high school, I was the kid everybody looked up to as being the smartest one. I had won the Whale Radio Outstanding English Student Prize. I had won the Brown University Prize for Ability in English Expression, both written and oral, and the Claiborne Pell American History Medal. So I thought I could rise to any challenge and get my mind around anything that came my way. And so following my freshman advisor's suggestion, I took an advanced English class that first semester at Yale called From Chaucer to Eliot. And as you can suspect, I should have known, I bombed. This Yale at the time was preparing an educational preparation for people who'd come out of the wealthy prep schools. And the wealthy prep school kids were well-versed in forms of literary theory I had never heard of. They knew how to study and when to speak up in class. I also found myself drowning in literature of Greece and Rome because these were the kinds of topics that they didn't even tell us about at Tiverton High School, much less taught us how to deal with. Yeah, for me, Yale was an education designed for the educated financial elite of America that was trying to be a democratic ideal of opening it up to students coming from working-class backgrounds who with great promise, but they didn't prepare us. They didn't have any supports at the time. I didn't know how to study it, what the professor wanted, or even how to ask for help. And I was thick-headed and working-class enough to try figuring it out entirely on my own and too ashamed to seek help. A working-class kid just never would admit that they didn't do it. So I'm deeply grateful for my experience at Yale, but it was quite humiliating.
Yes, I completely understand. And here you are, yet it was the gateway for you, I mean, and for me, you know, to be able to have that kind of an education, to have that stamp. I mean, you tell someone you're a Yale graduate, they immediately think you're smart and successful. It's a
right.
great door opener. And you took that as a doorway into quite an incredible life. I mean, you went from there to Harvard Business School and then stepped right out as an international consultant at Bain, where you were really successful. So talk about how it felt to come from where you did, go through kind of the humiliation and challenge, no longer being the smartest kid in the school, but you got through it, you graduated, and now you're a high-level, well-paid international consultant. How did that feel for you?
It was lovely. It meant everything I would ever hope for and more. As you say, the Yale diploma, surviving Yale, gave me a Yale diploma, even though it says by skin of teeth. And when I was trying to decide what to do next after Yale, I took I went to a Harvard Business School seminar, and they were recruiting, and I asked them if I could come from my kind of background with my kind of grade point, and they said to me it was entirely dependent on how I did on the GMATs, the graduate, the management test. So I took the GMATs and aced them, and that was my doorway into Harvard Business School. But what I had discovered at Yale was that it was my lack of preparation, more than my lack of intelligence, that had gotten in my way of success at Yale. So I just plowed into everything you could possibly learn about the case study method and how do you succeed at Harvard Business School, organizing my own study group, getting us to support each other in class, working basically 90 hours a week to emerge quite quickly as one of the best students at the school. And so when I came out of Harvard with in the top 3% of my class, or with the highest honors, I was quite surprised that Bain & Company was quite happy to hire me to have me be an international strategy consultant, even though I had no real business experience, because I had the kind of quick wit and a quick learning curve that they needed to have in that kind of role.
Yeah, so off you go, and you're in London, you're in Germany, you're having fun solving these big problems. I loved your story of advising Guinness on how they could make more money and have a more effective workforce by stopping serving beer in the middle of the day.
It seems like an obvious thing. You shouldn't get your workers drunk all day in a brewery.
I just love it, though. It makes you feel like, yes, you know, we can deal with these big challenges.
I should be very clear, as I am in the book, that Bain will only hire me if I agreed to a social class makeover. They didn't call it that, but when they hired me at $40,000 a year, which is about $120,000 today, twice what anyone else was offering me, they said they wanted to give me an additional $5,000 signing bonus, which I thought was lovely, but they said it was on the condition that I used it to take it on the look of an upper-class WASP. The partner told me to go to Brooks Brothers to buy blue pinstripe and gray flannel suits, to the custom shop to have white shirts tailor-made to my build, to Louis for red silk ties from France, and to churches to buy English black Oxford leather shoes. This was an American social class makeover, and I took to it with enthusiasm like I do everything else because it led to becoming rich and never experience poverty again. But it did require that I be willing to change my sense of self and the way I presented myself to make myself attractive for these boards of directors on the international corporate scene.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways we need to adapt to kind of make it in those new settings, but you did and you thrived. You were, you know, obviously highly intelligent, very creative, hardworking. You did an amazing job at Bain. And then you went out and became a founder and leader of the biotech industry. What attracted you to the biotech industry?
It was the same nature of when I left Bain, I had access to their research library, and I was 28. And so I was trying to find what industry was going to be centered in Boston, since my wife and daughter wanted to live here in the Boston area, and that I could come into as a senior manager at 28, so I didn't have to earn my stripes again, and that was going to grow and do good things in the world. And when I did the research, by far, biotechnology looked like the way I could have the most positive impact on the world in the most fun environment in which to work. It just required that we had to invent an industry as we were going. But again, having started learning how to reinvent myself and reinvent industries at Bain, it looked like an interesting challenge.
Well, I'll say, I mean, you helped invent a whole industry. And I would say to our listeners, it's worth reading your book, Spiritual Audacity, if only to read about your experience as one of the founders and leaders in the biotech industry. It's an amazing tale, and you tell it with great verve and honesty. But just to give our listeners a brief flavor here, you know, you were the founder and president of the Massachusetts Biotech Council, you at the CFO of Genzyme, and that wild ride up and down, same as the chair and CEO of TSI. Just give our listeners a little bit of a flavor of what was that wild ride like in helping to create and guide the biotech industry in its infancy.
Well, I'm going to tell you two stories. They're both in the book, but they're some of my favorite stories about that period. One of the things we were doing in biotechnology, since we were competing with these much better financed and larger pharmaceutical companies, is we were creating environments where scientists could flourish and that they would do things for us and with us that they never would have done if they were in a big corporate setting. So our first product for addressing a large market was a treatment for Gaucher's disease, basically extracting from human placenta from live births the enzyme glucocerebrisidase needed to treat this rare genetic disease that lots of kids, thousands of kids were suffering from and were dying from. We developed it over a number of years and finally had it ready to go into the clinic. And when it was making the first batch of it, it finally had enough to treat the first patient in phase one clinical trials. The chief scientist came in to the weekend just to make sure everything was ready to take down to treat this young boy. His name was Brian. And it turns out there'd been a power outage in Chinatown where our lab was located, and the backup generators had failed to kick in. So now his frozen material had risen above freezing, and we had no idea scientifically what that would do. So he froze it back down, took it, and treated Brian, and it turned out it was a miraculous cure, that Brian's lipids broke up, he was restored to a normal state, he'd have to get this treatment on a regular basis the rest of his life, but this disease that otherwise would have killed him now would not do so. When we then tried to make further batches and through more trials, none of the subsequent trials worked. And having done three more trials and having them all fail, any big pharmaceutical company who has internal protocols basically would have said, just abandon it, that this is a failed clinical trial. But instead, the scientists went back and said, what could possibly have changed by having it go above freezing and go back down below freezing? And he discovered that there were sugars on the outside of the protein that we were using, and that by cleaving one of the sugars when it went above freezing, it made the product now be taken up in the body in the right cells, hepatocytes, so that they could treat this disease. And that became the core of the first billion-dollar product for Genzyme, which this kind of enzyme remodeling. We invented its carbohydrate remodeling of enzymes. We invented a whole new field of science just by scientific curiosity, figuring out how can we save this little boy's life.
Amazing.
And when I tried to take Genzyme public as a public company, this was 1986, at that time there hadn't been a lot of companies going public that were unprofitable. That's very common now from the technology industry, but we were among the first wave of companies trying to go public without any pathway to profits. I had to write these disclosure statements for the initial public offering that said, we've never been profitable. We're not sure we ever will be profitable. We have no idea how we would be profitable. And when I took it to the analysts and then to the SEC, we were negotiating how to do the accounting to make us look at least as reasonable as we could. And in the end, they finally told us that our core product, this treatment for Gaucher's disease, could not be used public funds for that purpose because it didn't have any pathway to profits. So we had to use the IPO money for other purposes, and we went back to the drawing board and came up with the first R&D limited partnerships, which we based on what had been real estate limited partnerships before us, and got the SEC to clear it so that we could now raise money from investors, let them write off their investment completely as we spent the monies bringing the product forward, and then buy back the product for stock, appreciated stock, when it was successful. This created a whole, well, it increased our research capability threefold of what we could manage to do, and it ended up putting me on the cover of CFO Magazine as the most creative CFO in the biotechnology industry.
Yeah, so it's a great field in biotech in the sense that you can save lives like you do with that young boy, Brian, and also use your intellect and creative problem-solving abilities to come up with some of these creative financing strategies. So, it's just you had an amazing experience in that whole field. So you then became a kind of venture capitalist, venture catalyst, helping start many other companies and investing with them and guiding them. And essentially, you made a lot of money, you lost a lot of money, and then you made it again. What would you say you have learned by making and losing and remaking all that money?
Life has its ups and downs. And if you take risks, sometimes it's going to turn out quite badly. But I had been working 80 or 90 hour weeks at both of the startups that I had been building. I mean, they were growing 100% a year, and you had to put that kind of time into it. And after TSI blew up, when they first announced that Hillary Clinton was going to put in caps on drug prices back in 93, the whole business just imploded. And when I was looking at for the next opportunity to be an entrepreneur again, thinking this is what I was intended to do, my astute 11-year-old daughter was smart enough to say to me that she said, Dad, you're not temperamentally suited to both be the father in this family and building companies. And I looked at her and I go, I'm a nationally recognized entrepreneur. Why do you say that? She goes, here's what happens. You find these brilliant ideas. You get very excited. You hire tens of people, lots of scientists, and then you raise tens of millions of dollars, and it never works out the way you thought. So even when you're with us, you're still thinking about them, and it takes up all of your energy. So I decided there was another way to be wealthy, to be financially secure, and not have to have my family pay that sacrifice, that I had enough experience and stature in the industry that I was able to announce that my family name, Sjöblom, means seaflower in Swedish. So I was announcing that I would now be a venture catalyst, that I would advise and help people if I could go on their board and make small investments that are likely to be high return. But I would do it such that I would be at board meetings with them and working in the mornings and early afternoon and be back home to watch my daughter play soccer or go hiking with my son by the later in the day. And it turns out you can have that balance if you're disciplined about it. And in fact, in my case, it took us almost another 10 years to win back all of the money we had lost. But eventually we got back to complete financial security while having a much closer relationship with both of my children who are now in their 30s.
Fantastic. You know, it's just such a great model for, you know, making sure we have the financial freedom and making sure we take the time to be with our family.
Not everybody has that option. Not everybody has the chance to either make a fortune or find ways to decide how much. But I do think everybody at some level can decide what their priorities are. And embracing life with a sense of generosity is really an important spiritual practice, to being able to sort of open up the possibilities of what can you do in your life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And speaking of priorities, after you remade your fortune, you decided to become a Unitarian minister. So what happened? Was that a spiritual awakening? Was it following in the footsteps of your father, the minister? Why did you make that shift from a business over to becoming a Unitarian minister?
It was some of both of those and things and more. So I was out raising the third fund for the venture fund, and I was, as a managing partner, the primary rainmaker. And the industry, this was in 1999, the industry was changing so that it was focused far more on financial returns, short-term financial returns, than it was about long-term building companies. And I had always been in the industry because I wanted to build companies and new technologies and save lives. So I was getting tired. I was now in my late 30s, and then increasingly finding these young people in their 30s or even 20s sitting on the boards of these big institutions that we were trying to get to invest, trying to tell me how I should have behaved differently in building companies, and telling me that they really didn't care what happened to the company. They just cared about their financial return. So I was sitting one night coming back from a jet lagged, coming back from a Asian fundraising trip, and complaining about to my wife that this was no longer the kind of fun that I had been having over the previous decade in biotechnology. So she said to me that since she'd married me as one of the happiest people she knew, if I'm not happy, I should figure out what I needed to do. The following week, I got a postcard from my dad's old seminary, the Andover Newton Theological School, for inviting me to go spend a day with them. Now, there's no way anyone can tell me how they found me in Concord, Massachusetts at that particular point in time, since he had graduated from the seminary in the 40s, long before I was born. And my calendar never had an open day in my schedule, but I looked at the day they suggested and it was wide open. So I went to my assistant and I said, how is this day wide open? And she said, you were supposed to speak at that conference on the West Coast and it got canceled or postponed, so now you've got a day free. So I took that as a sign and went to visit the school, and I loved the classes and the professors and the students, but even more so I loved talking about things that had real meaning and being able to help people with the nature of their lives. I remembered how much I envied my father's line of work as a Baptist minister. So at the end of the day, I called up my wife, Loretta, and told her that I was now enrolling at Andover Newton to part time in order to become an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister. And Loretta, who is a secular humanist, basically had a long pause, and she said, you could take up golf. Any men deal with their midlife crisis by taking up golf.
That's a great story. It sounds like what a wife might say, too.
Oh, Loretta and I have been together now for almost 40 years, and we have this very close but very open and honest relationship.
It's very impressive, and I love in your book how it's clear you're still madly in love with your wife. In fact,
yes.
If there's anyone listening who's in Hollywood or into making films, I highly recommend someone make a film about your life, and that they orient the whole your life story around the great love story between you and your wife, Loretta. Just take a minute here to say, you met Loretta while we were in college, and you're still together these 40 years later. You say your wife is your salvation. Talk
yes.
about that. Tell our listeners about that.
So I met Loretta when I had just gone through a really bad time at Yale. I had torn my hand, one hand wide open, my right hand, my writing hand, on a riot gate, and I was struggling to complete my classes. I had to drop some of my favorite courses because they were too painful to type them. I had been engaged to the first woman who introduced me to sex my freshman year at Yale, and now she had betrayed me, and so we had split, and I really wasn't sure I could trust anybody. I was failing on any number of fronts. But when I first saw Loretta, she was running for treasurer of the Yale Political Union, and I was one of the active senior people in the Party of the Right, which is a debating society. And the first time I saw her, I just immediately knew this was someone I could build a life with. So when she left the room, I helped use all of my articulateness to try and sway the vote. She was easily elected, and I asked her out the following week, and she turned me down. She had the other commitments. And so we had to go back and forth on this a couple times for her to see why, as a very smart, highly educated Chinese-American, daughter of Chinese immigrants, she should be interested in this really small-town, working-class white kid who wasn't doing very well in that environment. But as we finally, the third time I asked her out, I had proposed to her that we go sit out, take my car, since I was an upperclassman and I had a car on campus, take my car and go sit out at Lighthouse Point, just outside New Haven at the beach, and watch the moon rise. And she said that was the best offer anybody had given her. So we went out and spent 6 hours sitting there watching the moon rise and talking and sharing our lives back and forth. And by the end of the time, we were dating. And ever since then, every time I face trials and tribulations, I have Loretta there at my side, knowing that she has got my best interests at heart, our best interests at heart, and helping me to overcome any sense of doubt or shame or shortcomings of not being able to do things. And it's been extraordinary that I've been able to provide her with a relationship that works really well for her, and we've created a great home environment for our two kids. But it really is, it made a very different life trajectory for me than if I had married somebody else.
Yeah, what an incredible love story. I think it's amazing. And I love that you speak so highly of your wife. It speaks well of you. So you're telling her now, after you've made all this money in business, lost it, made it back again, that you want to become a Unitarian minister. And she says, why don't you take up golf? But
initial reaction was not, was trying to be as supportive as she could, but she was not really very supportive of it. Partly because she had watched my mother, who was the 1970s Baptist minister's wife, which was basically unpaid work, and always being in the background. And that's not Loretta. Loretta is a very successful entrepreneur, having built her own business over the last 30 years. It took her a while to believe me when I told her that today ministers' wives or husbands really have those expectations, that they are allowed to lead their own lives and that they're there primarily for the moral support of the minister who's doing a very difficult job. When she finally saw that was true, she went to our minister here in Concord and borrowed his liturgical stole that he wore every Sunday, and she is a great seamstress, so she then made me 3 liturgical stoles that I could wear when I was leading congregations as her way of saying, okay, this is what we're going to do together.
That's awesome. And she was right to encourage you to think about what would make you happy when you had, the joy had gone out of the entrepreneurship, and
right.
And you found that. And good for her for supporting you and doing what made you happy in a way that allowed her to do what made her happy, too. So it's part of how I think our whole generation was really rewriting the script of what marriage means and what the roles of husbands and wives are, and particularly, you know, the role of women as out there equally as professionals as the men out there doing the work in the world, and likewise giving men more of an opening to be more active fathers, more active parents, and more time with their children. So I think you are a living example of how our generation was really rewriting the story of marriage and family.
Right. And the piece that's become clear to me that was not as clear at the beginning was that we don't have to find an arrangement between us spouses for all time. It's over the course of a lifetime, it shifts. So that when I was an entrepreneur and working 80 or 90 hours a week, she really was primary parent for our kids. But when I reached another stage of my life and was able to have a much more balanced life, that freed her up to pour her energies into building her business in a way that has been quite rewarding, both satisfactory, giving her great joy and satisfaction, as well as financial support that allows me to then go off and spend my time doing things that are not nearly as financially lucrative, but help to make the world a better place.
Right. And you chose to live in one of my favorite towns in the world, Concord, Massachusetts, the home of the Transcendentalists. Tell our listeners, who were the Transcendentalists and what do they mean to you?
So what happened from my perspective on a world stage in the latter part of the 18th century is we, for the first time, had good translations and inexpensive books printed of these Indian and Chinese religions. So Hinduism and Buddhism, the Bhagavad Gita and the Dhammapada and the Tao Te Ching from China. And suddenly, if you look at it, what happened is first it was the German philosophers who started, Hegel and Kant, started transforming and creating what came to be known as German idealism. And then the English, in England, it flourished with the Romantic poets, with this greater realization that there's another level of, from beyond mundane reality, that if we just open ourselves up to it, that we can experience trees and sunlight and love and connection in a different, more powerful way. So Ralph Waldo Emerson was in the early 19th century studying at Harvard and first got access to some of these books and was training to become a minister, a Unitarian minister, and he went and served a church in Second Parish in Boston, but he was troubled between what he called the tradition that he had inherited, what he called corpse cold Unitarianism, and this tradition he was reading about from England and Germany with these new texts where people were engaged with life at a much higher level. And he fell in love with a woman that was the love of his life, and they married, but she was already dying when they married. She died about 18 months later, and at that point, he just crashed. He resigned his position as a minister. He came out to Concord to his grandfather's house, the old manse here in Concord, because his grandfather had been a minister here in town. And he gradually tried to decide what made meaning, and he came up with a form of transcendentalism that is very nature-based and attracted around him a number of people, Margaret Fuller, Frederick Henry Hedge, Theodore Parker, people who really got into the transcendentalism and each took it in a slightly different way. His most prolific student and the one that we most regard it to these days was a young man who followed him at Harvard, Henry David Thoreau. And Thoreau basically took it to its logical extension, partly because he graduated from Harvard in 1837, which was the worst recession in America until the 2008 one. And Thoreau decided that when his older brother, who was his closest companion, died from lockjaw, a shaving cut, and then Ralph Waldo Emerson's five-year-old son Waldo died shortly thereafter, he decided to just take 2 years of his life and go build a little cabin by Walden Pond and contemplate the meaning of life, write his first book, which was this, about their travels together with his brother, and trying to figure out what this would be like to live transcendentally. So my two big lures to coming to Concord, because I had been introduced to them in high school and just found them resonating so deeply for me, was Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. I like to say that Emerson is my teacher and Thoreau is my life coach.
Interesting. Well, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau are just like incredible historic figures for the country and certainly for Concord and Massachusetts there. And living in Concord, where they lived, you walk around Walden Pond, where Henry David Thoreau lived in the woods alone for a couple of years. And by the way, Walden Pond is my watering hole. It's where I swam when I grew up. I grew up the early part of my life in Arlington, Mass, and Walden Pond was our closest pond to swim in. And I go back there even now to do distance swimming all the way across the pond and back. So it's an amazing place. It is so peaceful, and you can feel the presence of Thoreau there. I encourage our listeners to read that book, too, about Walden, about Thoreau's time living alone in the woods for 2 years. And
so, Eleanor, let me add you to a list that's a growing list of people that I'm a member of the Thoreau Society, and so we bring academics from around the world who want to come here because this is the central place for American Transcendentalism. And I have a growing list of people who send me emails before they come to Concord, reserving a time that we can go walking around the Walden Pond together.
Oh, fantastic. I would love to do that. It's just such an amazingly peaceful place. I'm reluctant to tell our listeners because it's like a secret place to go that's so deeply peaceful. But I love how you talk in your book and your story of your life, how nature has always been a way for you to find deep inner peace.
Yes. That I am a nature mystic. It took me a long time growing up the son of a Baptist minister to discover that nature mystics is my way to connect with the divine.
Yes, it's fabulous. So I want to ask you about, because your memoir focuses on human flourishing. So can you explain what do you mean by human flourishing and how does it relate to your life? Why did you use it as kind of the main focus for organizing your life story?
If I were to say the one thing that I'm most dissatisfied with America today is, it's a lack of providing means for people to flourish.
Uh-huh.
That we all have the ability to thrive in the midst of turbulence, to do enormous things, but we can't achieve those things if we don't know what's possible. So since I was small, I've been focused on why does one human being react into life's trials and tribulations, emerge stronger with greater health and well-being, which we all know from the clinical trials, the results that people react to life differently, while another human being facing very similar trials and tribulations is crushed with a broken spirit. For me, that led me gradually to conclude that there were a small number of disciplines that encouraged flourishing and that I could see them having been developed without a guide in my own life over the last first 6 decades of my life. So now that I was stepping down from my last active engagement and deciding to write, I said, what do I have to offer people? And I said, well, if I can give them those 6 lessons, those 6 practices that lets you flourish as a human, full human, fully awake human being, that would be my best ministry for this next stage of my life.
Right, and so if we all can develop those 6 practices, we can flourish too. Is that the basic idea?
Yes, that we all have an ability to improve our resilience, to we have the ability to transcend our ego and surrender ourselves to the greater good. We have an ability to find reasons for gratitude, even for things we didn't necessarily want, and to embrace the world with a generosity of spirit. We have an ability to let go of holding on too tightly to our notion of reality and accepting that the divine mystery will never be fully understandable to us. It's not capable of being fully understood by human beings. And that we can awaken to a state of transcendentalism that makes us more full of joy and equanimity in dealing with the world.
Well said, and I think your life is testimony that those 6 practices really have worked well in your own life to help you get both financial freedom and also a really fulfilled life with your family and spiritual enlightenment and deep nourishment from your spiritual life. So I think it's always good to learn from people who have walked the walk and learned the lessons themselves. Why don't you take one of those, like I was impressed in your book about the way you talked of gratitude and saying anybody can be grateful when things are good, but truly we need to develop a sense of gratitude for everything that happens in our lives, even the things that seem bad or traumatic actually can be positive for us. So tell us a little bit about your experience with the importance of gratitude.
Well, I probably grew up with the same notion most people have, that you should things are either objectively good or objectively bad, and we should be grateful for the good things and avoid the bad things. But since I had such a traumatic time in my early 20s, it completely changed my sense of the role of gratitude in helping us create something, transform our life in some way, taking both the bad and the good and just finding ways to use it to our good effect. So as we mentioned, when I was 20, I was in utter despair, physically unable to pursue my dreams. I was betrayed by my fiancé, depressed, verging on flunking out of college, overwhelmed, no clear path forward. And yet, setting that aside and not letting that depress me, suppress my capability, let me build a relationship with Loretta 2 years later that really helped me to discover just how many things I could be grateful for, including how hard Yale was for me. And that with deep resilience and surrender of my ego self, I found that, you know, over the next several years, things changed completely around. So you can imagine my joy and gratitude at 28 when we moved back to the States from having lived in Europe. Loretta and I happily married. She knew me better than I know myself. We had a baby daughter. My work paid extraordinarily well. Everything was going well with our life, but really it required that I be prepared to hold that lightly too, so that if things then blew up there, it didn't put me into a tailspin again, but rather just gave me something new to weave with, because our joys and our sorrows are woven very fine together. If we engage with life, we get to experience both of those. If we live life with audacity, as I encourage people in the book to do, our joys and our sorrows multiply, and this is the nature of being human. The Buddha says life is suffering. We're not rocks, we're not islands. Because we love, we'll be inevitably will be hurt. But how we engage with that allows us to be transformed in the process, and for that, we should always be grateful.
Absolutely. And along with the gratitude is the incredible resilience that you demonstrated. And you said at the beginning of this call, when I asked how did you get from poverty to financial freedom, and the first thing you said was resilience. So resilience is definitely one of those themes and practices that's been woven through your life and helped you rebound from really devastating losses.
And part of that has been being open to the mentors who can help along the way. I mean, my relationship with Loretta has been my core relationship. But as early as fourth grade, I had a teacher who recognized that I didn't seem to care. I was bored in class, so she gave me a lot of extra work to do, which I'd have to go to the library to research and do. In high school, I had an English department chair who took me under his wing and introduced me to all of these brilliant books, including Hegel and Kant and the Transcendentalists, American Transcendentalists. And it was he who had been Harvard-educated who was able to basically on the side, outside the standard curriculum for my high school, which would not have gotten me to Yale, to help me self-direct and learn all of the things I needed to get to Yale. I have probably had a dozen such relationships over the course of my life where somebody would appear and be able to help me through that next stage if I was just willing to say thank you.
Right, exactly, to say thank you. And along with that, kind of another practice is your generosity of spirit and your generosity of prosperity and kind of the giving back. So talk a little bit about that generosity and how that's expressed itself and what it means to you.
So I grew up in a Baptist family, and so we practiced tithing, giving away 10% of everything. And when I first met Loretta, who's the daughter of Chinese immigrants, she thought that was a rather surprising practice, that a family that had next to nothing would give away 10% of it. But I pointed out to her that it makes the other 90% feel like it's so much more, and that you own that, you have a right to it because you've been generous to others. So we have had a long 40-year practice of trying to find places we can be generous to others, and it really does help rebound back to us for our own sense of self that we are playing our appropriate role in the world. That I always had this problem with congregations when we were talking about how much they should give to the church and how much they should give to social justice causes and to make the world a better place. I said, well, it's pretty obvious to me that if you give less than 10%, you're shorting yourself. Now, fortunately, we belong in a very liberal denomination where they only expect 2.5% of your household income to go to support the church. So most of our money has gone to help inner-city kids who need money to help them get to college or to do planting of trees to prevent climate change, things that we care deeply about. But it's not only are we having an impact that we love to have, but it changes who we are and the way we behave with the rest of our wealth. And I think it makes it far more powerful for us to get the most out of our lives.
Well, you've lived an amazing life, and you are an amazing being, and you wrote an amazing book. So we're out of time now, but I encourage our listeners to get your book, Spiritual Audacity, by Reverend Dr. Jim Sherbloom, and tell our listeners, how can they find out more about you and the book?
I have a website, author's website, jimsherbloom.com, and you can go to Amazon now and pre-order Spiritual Audacity. It'll be out in a couple weeks, or even better, go to your local bookstore and tell them that you want them to pre-order it so when it comes out.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on a fascinating life, well lived, and I know there's another chapter to come.
There is indeed. Thanks very much, Eleanor.
Sure. Reverend Dr. Jim Sherbloom, thank you so very much for being with us today. In case you've missed any of our programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday at 3 o'clock Eastern. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.